Well, I thought I would begin again with a prayer from Buechner's book. O thou who comes, who are the hope of the world, give us hope. Give us hope that beyond the worst the world can do, there is such a best that not even the world can take it from us. Hope that none whom you love is ever finally lost, not even to death. O thou who died in loneliness and pain, suffer to die in us all that keeps us from you and from each other and from what we have it in us at our best and bravest to become. O thou who rose again, Holy Spirit of Christ, arise and live within us now, that we may be your body, that we may be your feet to walk upon the world's pain, your hands to heal, your heart to break, if need must be, for love of the world. O risen Christ, may Christ of us all. Amen. Well, I thought maybe since I'm going to hurry into this, ferry into this difficult waters here today, talking about masculine spirituality, I should tell you this joke about a Catholic priest who is all excited about the changes, the liturgical changes that came out of Vatican II. I remember my brother had a parish, it's a wonderful pastor, but he was just into all the changes, and he said to me one day, he said, you know, Karen, if we could have colored holy water, we'd have it. I thought his priest was really, always had. Well, this particular priest was really taken with all the liturgical changes and updating, and he would come out at the 10 o'clock Mass on Sunday, and he would try to get the congregation to really respond, you know, enthusiastically, because when I was growing up, there was a server, and actually the way it would go is the priest would mumble the Latin, and then the server would mumble the Latin response, and you know, you could sit back in the pew and say your rosary. It really, you know, you could follow along in your missal, but there wasn't very much activity, and there was a choir usually, and the choir did most of it. And so as a parishioner, you were pretty much on your own, you know? Well, of course, the changes in Vatican II then had turned the priest around to face the congregation, and it was a whole new way of life for most of us. So he would try and come out there and get them to make these English responses. And so he would say, the Lord be with you. And then they would kind of say, and with you too. And he said, well, come on now, and with you too. And so he would really work with them about 10 minutes before Mass, so he'd get them up and they would say it loud enough for him and enthusiastically enough. So it came to the offertory of the Mass, and he went behind the altar now that was facing the community, and he had trouble with the microphone. And so he said, there's something wrong with this mic. And the entire community answered, and also with you. So you're probably thinking right now, there's something wrong with her. All these things that we're talking about here. Well, yesterday we talked about the women's journey, and today we want to talk about the men's journey. And this is where I miss my colleague, because I usually do this with James Evelyn, who I teach with at Seattle University. And that's one of the reasons I used to do this on my own, actually. I should maybe tell you, maybe I said this to you, this all kind of started for me because I taught New Testament. That's my area of expertise and specialty. And then I also was asked to teach a course on theology of the feminine, because I was the only woman on the staff. And so when I came to Seattle University, I taught that course, plus I did the New Testament courses, and I began to see some really useful applications and connections, and so I would bring those in. But then, of course, I had men in the class too, so then I would try and do something with that part of it. And I used to use a wonderful little book by Sam Keen called Beginnings Without End, which I recommend you, which is really a journal that he kept when he came to a real crisis in his life and began to write down what he was really coming to in that crisis. And he has that book divided into seasons, beginning with, I think it was autumn, fall, and then winter, spring, and summer. And it has that the kind of unfolding of a process. And I used that for a while. But in working with Jim Eblin, he has been using the work done by Robert Moore. And so it's that book which I want to share with you and talk with you about. It's actually by Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette, and it's called King, Warrior, Magician, Lover. And the subtitle is the one I have for this session, called Recovering the Archetypes of the Mature Masculine. Sometimes it's called the Healthy Masculine. So I want to share pretty much the material from this book. I got this first from a series of tapes that he did, which is available through NCR. The National Catholic Reporter has a set of tapes that he did. And now he has even, Jim just told me this week, that he has a new set that's coming out, which will be quite expensive when you buy them all, but it's like maybe six tapes on the king and six tapes on the warrior and so on. So. And he's a psychotherapist who also teaches at the seminary in Chicago. So he's working with a lot of this material. His introduction begins, he says, "We face a crisis in masculine identity of vast proportions." Increasingly, observers of the contemporary scene, sociologists, anthropologists, and depth psychologists, are discovering the devastating dimensions of this phenomenon, which affects each of us personally as much as it affects our society as a whole. He attributes this crisis to two things, two major things. One is the disappearance of ritual processes for initiating boys into adult malehood. He says, "We have done away with the processes by which both men and women achieve their gender identity in a deep, mature, and life-enhancing way." He argues that he's speaking mostly to masculine spirituality, is really what he's talking about, although he does now and then say he thinks this works for women also. Instead of a king, you would have a queen and so on. But we're going to focus this session on the masculine. So that's the first thing, the loss of these wonderful rituals that brought boys into manhood. The second cause, he says, is patriarchy. Now, you have no doubt hit women, outspoken feminists who blame patriarchy for everything. Original sin. But this is the first man, I think, who has challenged patriarchy as responsible for the crisis in male spirituality. He says, well, you know this. "Patriarchy is a social and cultural organization that has ruled our Western world and much of the rest of the globe since about the second millennium BC. He says, "Patriarchy is not the expression of deep and rooted masculinity. For truly deep and rooted masculinity is not abusive. Patriarchy is the expression of the immature masculine. It is the expression of boy psychology and in part the shadow and crazy side of masculinity. It expresses the stunted masculine fixated at immature levels. He says it's based on fear. The patriarchal male does not welcome the full masculine development of his sons or his male subordinates any more than he welcomes the full development of his daughters or his female employees. This is the story of the superior at the office who can't stand it that we are as good as we are. How often we are envied, hated, and attacked in direct and passive-aggressive ways, even as we seek to unfold who we really are in all our beauty, maturity, creativity, and generativity. The more beautiful, competent, and creative we become, the more we seem to invite the hostility of our superiors or even of our peers. What we are really being attacked by is the immaturity in human beings who are terrified of our advances on the road toward masculine or feminine fullness of being. It's just really a powerful statement of the cost of patriarchy to men. Women have certainly been preaching that pretty strongly. But that's why I find this book really has a lot to ponder and think about. Now, how he goes about this, in part one he talks about boy psychology. Now, in your booklet that I gave you, the center sheet is what we can look at here. How he goes about talking about these. Talks about the four archetypes now, and what he means by the archetypes are energies. And he says there are these four kind of primal energies from the human psyche. So we'll just talk about the male psyche here. And those are, as we said, the king, the warrior, the magician, and the lover. But of course, you're not born out of Zeus. Full-blown, you begin life as a boy. And so the manifestation of these energies, if you will, these powers, come out when you're a boy in a different way. I mean, after all, you're a child. So if you see, the top ones would be the mature, but below them would be the same thing as a boy. Now, some of you have a different organization of this, so you have to follow this differently, but this would be on page 16. So I want you to look at the pyramid below the king, which would be the divine child. All right. So in the boy, the energy is the divine child energy, and it's a sense that you're really pretty special. That there's no one like you before you, and there's no one going to be like you after you. So it's that sense of your own person and being. You're like this globe of wonderful energy and power, and you're pretty special. And of course, who tells you that? Well, your parents do, because they look at you like you're pretty special, huh? And you look back and you see that mirrored, so you have a sense of yourself. And that's really wonderful, and it's a source of energy. And what's so wonderful about this work, I think, is it says that's where your spirituality comes out from. I had a chaplain at Seattle U when I first was there that I found most helpful. And he talked about the most spiritual being in the whole world was a newborn baby. You know, all that energy. That's what spirituality is, that energy. And it's a pathology to think that when you're depressed somehow or other and there's no energy, that you're being holy. That actually it's energy that spirituality is about. And so the child gets all this kind of affirmation from the parent. It's really wonderful. I remember Eugene Laverde talking about the birth stories and talking about the star that appears in heaven. He says, well, it's not unlike the stars that appear in parents' eyes when they look at their child, you know. So that's the divine child. And those stories then, even the story of the birth of Jesus, really speaks about that kind of energy and acceptance and reality. Yeah? so that you have Jesus who's born, and of course Herod who's all upset by the challenge of this new energy that's now in the world. And so Herod, not being a good king, a negative king, wants to put that life out, wants to squelch that life because it would be a challenge to his own. But that story is also earlier versions of that appear in Zoroaster, so that you have this new life and it's such a threat that it has to be somehow it's going to be put out and then it's saved. And so it's a wonderful story, and it speaks to each of us in that power within us, that energy within us also. Now, in that divine child, if you notice, if you have too much of that energy, you become the high chair tyrant. So that your mother and father can't do enough to please you. So what you do is you abuse that power that you have. That it's an abuse of the love that you see, actually. So you hold that. And if you have too little of that as a child, you become the weakling prince. This is something like the child who plays the sick role in order to get attention, but then never achieves anything, never does anything, uses sickness as a way to keep that reflection going. So it's interesting that, again, I think what he's pointing at is both the positive and the negative. If you have too much or you have too little, it's something to really consider. Now, what he's arguing is that in a boy, that's correct, and that's fine. That's what it should be, with its positive and negatives, okay? But then that the king energy builds on that. It has to mature. So the divine child grows into the king. And that the king energy then has that same, the tyrant, right? If you have too much king energy and it's now balanced off by the other energies within you, that you become the tyrant. So a tyrant is one who has deficient energy and balance and integration with the other energies of the warrior and the lover and the magician. Mm-hmm.
Yes. At the child level, the infant level, are these bipolar places where the child may be naturally, or is this part of a dysfunctional family, or just how the family is functioning that puts the infant in either place by this theory?
I think it could be, certainly it wouldn't be the total responsibility of the child. It might be actually what is engendered within a family that is not, say, correctly balanced. He does talk about dysfunctional families and then how this role or this energy would be misused or misguided. So I think he would probably say with the child that the within the family those energies get distorted, and so there would be a balance of it. So yeah, I don't mean to blame the child in that sense. Be where the encouragement would come. A child who uses sickness, for instance, is trying to figure out how to manage, if you will.
But there's no base desire for the child to be at either one of these poles, either in general or in it, individually?
Well, I think my sense would be that the ideal would be that you would keep that divine child power would continue to be used by the child, but that it wouldn't be misused or that it wouldn't be misdirected within a family to abuse that power. And of course, with the divine child, that's balanced off by the hero and then the precocious child and the Oedipal child. So that this actually is not a pyramid, three-sided, it's a four-sided pyramid. So that he would, it's a way just of looking at it, but it's four-sided. And so what it is talking about is the need to balance and integrate those energies within a psyche. But all the work, I think, on dysfunctional families would indicate how those would get misconstrued and misdirected, that sort of thing, I think is going to be true. So, anyway, get back. So then the king, yes. Mm-hmm.
Does the high chair tyrant necessarily become the tyrant king then?
I think that would be the idea. Right, right. That, nevertheless, it's the adult king or the adult male, and too much energy. A lot of it is being able to see where your energy is making a tyrant out of you. And what he would argue is that you shouldn't then blame the energy. You need the energy. That's really basic to his own argument. What he says is something vital is missing in the inner lives of many of the men who seek psychotherapy. And what he's arguing is that these energies, which you really need for your spirituality, they are the spring waters of your spirituality, that they should not be capped or put down, but rather they should be recognized so that they become useful to you, so that you can draw upon those for your spirituality. And both Robert Bly, I think, he also has that word with his Iron John. You've done a lot of work along this, so if you can help me out, I'd appreciate that.
Basically, these are all archetypes that are within all of us. And so he's most of the dialogues with men. But like the high chair tyrant is that I also have them all as the tyrant. And at times when there's high anxiety or fear, that I regress back in. We all regress back in to one mode or another, where that archetype has more power than another. And these are called the parts of the shadow complex. All these bottom, the high chair and the weakling prince and the grandstander and the coward, these are all part of that part that we reject, but is still part of us. And so it's when it calls it bipolar, is that you swing from one side at one point and then you can swing from the other at another point. That if you don't get your way by pounding the table and slamming the door, then you'll try through passive manipulation of being sick or needy.
Yes, that's good. That's really good. What I find so interesting as a biblical scholar is how these archetypes can be found within the biblical stories. And of course, that would be the argument that these aren't something new now, but rather have been structured within, say, the myths and the stories, and then can be identified, and then can be a way for us, again, reading the text, to begin to identify that in our own behavior, in our own lives. So that's why I'm kind of heading in all of this. So, but to give you some notes on, I wanted to read you a little bit so that you could identify each of these, say, with the king. The king now is that power within you that centers, the power that calms and reassures. He suggests that the king is the one who engenders creativity and who gives blessing. One could say, I think, that the way many organizations are run, say the chairman or the president of a business is the one who should be centered, who's able then to facilitate the work of those that are under him or under her and engender that and celebrate it and feel good about it. Say at my university, I'd like to see the president of my university really take pleasure in the learning that goes on at the university. I'd like to see him in classes now and then and really supporting, if you will, and giving us all a sense that someone knows what we're about. Mm-hmm. In the tape, I don't know if you've seen that tape on PBS, it was an interview that of Robert Bly by Bill Moyers. And he uses the example, say, of Oliver North as a warrior who didn't have a king who was centered. So he's kind of a warrior out there on his own doing things. And of course, that's the tragedy when President Reagan said he didn't know this was happening. See, the king does know what's happening. That's the whole point. And the warrior is in service to the king who's centered. Otherwise, you have a warrior who has a lot of power and discipline and can get things done, but who doesn't have that centering power here. And it makes me wonder when you have, say, a president who talks about kick-ass and who, what's the other thing he says, read my hips, if you remember some of those remarks. And then, of course, who bans broccoli, you know. You just don't get the sense of someone who's centered. it's a little frightening. It's a little frightening. Anyway, so it says the two functions of the king in his fullness is the first is ordering. Someone who orders the creativity of those who are working together. And the second is the providing of fertility and blessing. And I like this, again, sticking with the masculine spirituality. He argues, young men today are starving for blessing from older men. Starving for blessing from the king energy. See, if there aren't positive kings out there, then it's very hard to develop and direct the positive king energy within you, because all of that kind of goes back and forth. You internalize that. And the argument he uses on these tapes that I listen to, and it's not maybe as strong in here in the book, is that we all have such negative images of these four archetypes. So when we think of king, we don't think about centering and celebration and of people's creativity and blessing. Those aren't the first images that come to mind when we hear the word king. Not even in the fairy tales, oftentimes.
Except Camelot.
Camelot, right. Mm-hmm. King Arthur. Yeah. But it almost stands out as the exception, doesn't it? I have a little bit in my book. I'm going to share that with you. Anyway, it says, this is why they cannot, as we say, get it together. These young men. They shouldn't have to. They need to be blessed. They need to be seen by the king. Because if they are, something inside will come together for them. That is the effect of blessing. It heals and it makes whole. That's what happens when we are seen and valued and concretely rewarded with gold perhaps dropped from the Pharaoh's hand for our legitimate talents and abilities. And that's that little statement I put in this book, which I really liked, Robert Bly. If you're a young man and you're not being admired by an older man, you're being hurt. Because the blessing is being withheld, which you really need that affirmation. That's just a wonderful piece of this. The tyrant king, then... thought this is interesting. The tyrant king in the father who makes war on his sons and his daughters' joy and strength, their abilities and vitality. He fears their freshness, their newness of being, and the life force surging through them, which is really, I think, what we have coming out of the story of King Herod in the Gospel of Matthew. I think fits that really well. Let's turn then and look at the warrior. Yes.
So a concrete example then of this blessing is that it becomes my responsibility to spend positive time with my nephews, for instance.
Right.
So that they know that I appreciate them in some kind of way, more than the casual kind of maybe it's yearly visits or whatever if they're at a distance.
Yes. It's not superficial. It's really. Mm-hmm. Kind of a profound effect that you can have. Moore argues on the tape is that the expressions that young people often have or see of that king power are the drug lords or the bullies on the playground. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who oftentimes will pay attention to the younger people and get them involved, even though it's an abusive way.
But at least they're warriors, not kings.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Exactly. But they look like kings,
yeah.
You know? Right. They're the ones who are in charge. Yeah. I think that's good. Yes, that's good. Then the next archetype is the warrior. Again, the warrior that's too strong, if you will, becomes a sadist, and the one that's too weak becomes a masochist there. The warrior is the one that always evokes energy in such a way that it polarizes him, it clarifies. So it does this as a part of getting things done. Again, our sense of warrior often is negative, as a warrior, one who lashes out and kills. But the positive warrior, the one that we really need, is the warrior who protects boundaries. There's a sense, knowledge of boundaries. It's a warrior that has the power to get things done, in other words, discipline. Unless you have a warrior, you won't get the energy you need to write your sermon. Because, you know, you remember last week's sermon was a little flat. Well, that just makes it that much harder this time to get the energy together to make that sermon better. I mean, I come out of a class sometimes and you think, oh gosh, why am I doing this? You know? Well, then it's the warrior energy that comes back and say, well, okay, so you lost that battle. Get going here and kind of pull it together and energize. And of course, that's what people say. If you're convinced or you find energy in what you're teaching or what you're preaching, then that's caught. And then you energize the warrior within the people you're talking to, I think is really what happens there. So you have to have this warrior energy. It's really important. And again, it makes this wonderful point that it's the warrior energy that we are going to need to solve the problem of drugs in America. It's a huge problem. It's going to take a huge amount of warrior energy to address. Or AIDS, to find not only a cure for AIDS, but what to do with these very, very sick people and the fear that they raise in the rest of us. Education in the United States, public education, is in serious problem difficulty. Warrior energy is really needed. So again, you can hear, I can hear throughout the book here the need to respect these energies, to cultivate them, to recognize them, to develop them, and not to crush them because the negative versions of them have caused so much harm. But to say we need to redirect those and reclaim them, that's really. So that would be the warrior energy. Then the magician.
Could I ask?
Yes, you sure can.
You know, you earlier indicated that the counterpart for a woman for king would be queen. What would be the counterpart of warrior for?
A warrior.
Huh?
You know, a warrior.
Okay.
A warrior. That is to say. If there's an energy that women needed, it would be the warrior energy to establish the boundaries.
Joan of Arc
would be an example of that.
Mother Teresa.
Yeah, she's certainly a little warrior in her way, isn't she? You know what happened is that there are early, very early representations, both in myths and in some of the early cave drawings, of women warriors, women hunters. But again, that got taken over in the gender division, if you will, of work, and so that we associate warriors as only men. But women also need a warrior energy. In particular, you say, it's fine when a man and wife are married. But what happens when the man dies? Then it seems the woman has to have that energy to look out for herself and protect herself. Or a father and her daughter. You can only protect your daughter so long, and at some point you won't be there. So that energy has to be activated within that person. I think that would be.
What would be the difficult in this
warriors like in the New Testament?
Oh, I'm going to come to that. I'm going to give you some examples of that. That's good. I'm just kind of setting you up, and then we'll turn to Mark's Gospel. Then the third one is the magician here, and the magician is the teacher, the one who is the has a know-how. Therapist would be a magician, someone who's able to take knowledge and transform. It's really an act of magic, if you will. A preacher, a minister, has that magician aspect in the work that they do. When people come and you're able to put them in touch with images or stories or information that transforms them, that's the magician power. An example of a really powerful magician in our times would be Carl Jung and the work that he did. And that's the example that Moore gives in on his tapes, I remember. And again, how that power can be misused, and how you can have someone who really is able to get you into some pretty dangerous parts of your psyche and then doesn't know what to do with that, you know, kind of leaves you stranded there. So that also can happen. So, I can give you a little. He says here, if we are accessing the magician appropriately, we will be adding to our professional and personal lives a dimension of clear-sightedness, of deep understanding and reflection about ourselves and others, and technical skill in our outer work, in our inner handling of psychological forces. So those are the things associated with the magician. And then the last one here is the lover. And Moore spends quite a bit of time suggesting that it's the lover that integrates all the other energies. That if the lover is missing, you're in big trouble. That it's the lover that temporizes, or the word I want, tempers the other energies. Huh? He says, the lover keeps the other masculine energy as humane, loving, and related to each other and to the real life situation of human beings struggling in a difficult world. The king, the warrior, and the magician, as we've suggested, harmonize pretty well with each other. They do so because without the lover, they are all essentially detached from life. We need the lover to energize them, to humanize them, and to give them their ultimate purpose, love. They need the lover to keep them from becoming sadistic. It's really kind of interesting. And the example, of course, he uses as the most positive expression of the lover is Jesus and his own work there that he has. I think this is nice, again, in terms of male spirituality. He ends this by saying, tragically, the unrelenting attacks on our vitality, he's talking about male vitality, and on our shining, you know, that globe of light when you're a little child, begin early in our lives. Many of us may have so repressed the lover in us that it has become very hard for us to feel passionate about anything in our lives. I remember when my little nephew, he was just the cutest little kid when he was 4 years old, and little David. And I remember his dad, my brother, used to wrestle with him, you know, and fight with him. And I think in his mind, you know, because he wanted him to be a man, he wanted him to be a boy. And I remember my little nephew saying to his dad, I'm not a fighter, Dad, I'm a lover. And it was true. I mean, he really, he was very close to his mother. And I think my brother was always afraid that, you know, he was going to end up being effeminate. You know? But what it's left, I think, is a real gap there in relationship. So that even now, he's 25 years old, he's closer to my sister-in-law than he is mm-hmm. to my brother. And I think it's a real grieving for my brother, because my brother was very, very close to my father. when my father died, I heard my brother saying to a friend of mine, I didn't lose my father only, I lost my best friend. And so he had been very, very close to my dad, and they shared a whole lot. And I don't know if there's anything they did except they were really close. And I think it's been a real hardship in my brother's life. My first nephew was born premature, and the oxygen in the incubator blinded him. And my brother is a great outdoorsman, and so his first son wasn't able to do a lot of the things that he did with my father. And then his second son, of course, you know, that he is something of a sportsman, but not as avid as my brother is. And it was that I think my brother was relying on to really make him close to his sons. So that's often, and I, as you perhaps know, that's one of the things that Robert Bly works on a great deal, is the absent father, or that troubled relationship between father and son. Anyway, so those are the four archetypes that Moore talks about, and then the need to recover, to identify negative expressions of those, I think, to recognize a power and see that the power itself is good, but then it can be used in a negative way. And so I wanted to use then the time to look at the Gospel of Mark and see if we can draw out some of these. And obviously in a sermon you can't give them all this background here, but I think it can guide you to see where you can make some remarks that can be useful to people. The one that I used, and I have this book I keep telling you about that I wrote, and I didn't read this beforehand, but it works really well, and this is a chapter I did on the king, or it's called Kingdom, and in the, if you have your Bibles there, we can look at chapter 6 of Mark's Gospel. Now, in the Gospel of Mark, it's just so interesting that the word king, or the title king, appears 12 times. And they're evenly divided between two scenes. 6 times they appear in this chapter, beginning with verse 17, which is a story of the beheading of John the Baptist and King Herod, who's just a wonderful expression of a negative king. What I say in this piece, if you remember that whole thing, he has the birthday party and so on, and then his wife's daughter dances for him, and then he says, I'll give you anything you ask, on the kind of great grandiosity, as if, you know, it was just his to give away, and all of that. And what I say is, this scene abounds in images of power, ambition, prestige, privilege, and riches. They're all the things associated with kings that kind of this scene evokes. And not too far, it seems to me, from kings as they come down to us through history. Opulence, kings being able to have their will done, whether it's for the good of the people they are king over or not. Kind of an abuse of power, if you will. King Herod, of course, the real historical King Herod, you know, this is within the Gospel here, but killed his own sons. I mean, it's just really... Nero, if you remember, killed his own mother. I mean, some pretty ghastly images of kings and that power being terribly abused. Then if you look in chapter 15 of Mark's Gospel, you have there Jesus treated as a king mockingly. Beginning with verse 2 of chapter 15, Pilate, who's playing the role of king for the Romans, questions Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He said to them in reply, "You say so." He said to him, the chief priests accused him of many things. Again, Pilate questioned, "Have you no answer?" And he gives no answer in the text. And then, of course, as this whole chapter is about the kingship of Jesus, but it's a completely different king. It's not a king that dominates. It's a king that here is really under someone else's power, but does not lash out, and somehow absorbs the pain and the abuse so that it does not spread. It's really a whole different king that comes out of here. The example I would give of Jesus as a warrior, I should say probably some more about Jesus as a positive king. Throughout the Gospel of Mark, you really have to see this as a story. What you see is that Jesus reaches out to those who have been marginalized in the kingdom, so that whereas King Herod has the courtiers and the wealthy and those who have power being the ones who are at his table, so we think of the courtiers, Jesus courts the lame, the sick, the blind, all of those who have no power. And so it just changes. It takes that whole idea of kingdom and turns it upside down. So those who have no power now have acceptance. And they have, they're the ones that become the pride, if you will, and the joy and the celebration of this king. So it's a whole different kind of king that comes out of there. And that's developed throughout the gospel is what I really need to say. In terms of the negative warrior, I think there are some wonderful texts, again, in chapter 14 of Mark's Gospel. Beginning with, chapter 27. I think that's a wonderful text there. This is right after the Lord's Supper. In chapter 14, verse 27. Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will have your faith shaken, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be dispersed.'" I mean, you know, you could say the general will be struck and the soldiers will run away. "But after I have risen up, been raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." I think that's the lover talking. Peter said to him, "Even though all should have their..." I'll be strong. I'll be the strong warrior. Then Jesus said to him, "Amen, I say to you, this very night before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." But Peter still doesn't get it. He says, but he vehemently replied, and that's, I mean, it's a wonderful word there, huh? Vehemently, huh? He strongly replied, "Even though I should have to die with you, I will not deny you." What wonderful warrior images those are. Then 43 is, I think, another good text to think about in terms of a warrior, that misuse of warrior energy. "Then while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, accompanied by a crowd with swords and clubs, who had come from the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. His betrayer had arranged a signal with them, saying, 'The man I shall kiss is the one. Arrest him and lead him away securely.' And he came immediately, went over to him and said, 'Rabbi,' and he kissed him." So it seems to me you have there a warrior who switched sides, who's traded loyalties, and uses his intimacy with Jesus to betray him. It's a really interesting, misuse of warrior energy there. And a little below that. What?
Or the misuse of the lover energy. Again, this word.
Yes. Yes, right. Both of those, I think. Those are really interesting. And then 47 is another good, interesting one. It says, verse 47, one of the bystanders drew his sword, struck the high priest's servant, and cut off his ear. Well, I mean, that's a rather mismanagement, if you will, of energy. You know. You know, just the impetuosity of it and so on. Now, it doesn't say Peter did it, by the way, but it would be something you might expect Peter to do, you know. You know, not a sword to the heart, you know, but off the ear. I mean, it's kind of funny. And then, of course, that tragic text, verse 50, and they all left him and fled. There's his army. There's his warriors. Not protecting boundaries, if you will, but looking out for themselves. Interesting. Now, the positive warrior imagery, I think, comes in the agony of the garden, which is on that same page you have there. Remember, the warrior is the one who serves the king. The king is the one that has the overview, if you will, and the warrior serves that. It seems to me that's what you have here, is in contrast to Peter's kind of impetuous grandiosity and so on. You have Jesus, who really knows the cost, who really faces what this is going to mean, and then prays, actually, to give him a different assignment, because he knows this assignment is so costly. And then concludes by saying, but not as I will, but as you will. So God there, I think, in the scene is the king, and Jesus is a warrior. And it's warrior energy that gives him the strength he needs to go forward. It's a really positive warrior energy that you see there, where he doesn't hide. Huh? Would have been a warrior energy that he even came into Jerusalem, knowing how dangerous that would be for him and what was ahead of him. The magician, there's some nice examples of that in this gospel also. I'm going to talk more about that this afternoon, because in the Gospel of Mark, it is Jesus as a teacher healer that is so strong, and so I'm going to come more out of that. So the magician, remember, is the one who has the know-how, who has the skills and so on. So Jesus' healing is always in connection with teaching, or his teaching is healing, if you will. But some negative examples, I think, would come along in chapter 9 of Mark's gospel. And this will be right after your sermon here on the Transfiguration. If you remember, they're up there on the mountain. And when they come down, beginning with verse 15, remember, Jesus took just the three of them up on the mountain. It's the same three he took with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. So it says, when they came down to the disciples, the rest who were waiting there, they saw a large crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. Immediately on seeing him, the whole crowd was utterly amazed. They ran up to him and greeted him. He asked them, what are you arguing about with them? And they said, someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I have brought to you my son possessed by a mute spirit. And then he describes it and so on. And he says, I asked your disciples to drive it out, but they were unable to do so. So you have their magicians who are powerless to really perform this cure. And so then Jesus, he brings the boy to Jesus and so on, and he fills him. What I think is so interesting about this, verse 22 says, 24, it has often thrown him, this disease, into the fire, into water to kill him. But if you can do anything, he says to Jesus, have compassion on us and help us. I think where the magician operates is when he says, if you can. Everything is possible to one who has faith. So he's evoking the faith of the man. Which you can probably figure out, this isn't the way the disciples went about it. They were taken with, quote, their know-how, and they were not using that in such a way as to evoke the faith within the man that empowers the cure. And at the end of this little passage, the disciples say to him, you know, in private, why could we not drive it out? And Jesus says, this kind can only come out through prayer. So it's not your own power that's going to do it. Not your own know-how, if you will. I think it's a wonderful text on the kind of a negative magician there. And then the lover, a couple texts there. Certainly the text about Jesus with the children, blessing the children, is a wonderful lover text. This is in chapter 10, verses 13 to 16. Suppose you could use it also as a king text, couldn't you, with the blessing of the text there. Be another one. But I like the text that says, and then he embraced them and blessed them, placing his hands on them. That whole healing aspect of touching. And we usually think of loving and touching and loving touches and so on. But the one I really think is strongest in this gospel and that I like the best, it's the one I touched on before, is when he's with his disciples at the Last Supper and he talks about their betrayal. And I think it's the lover's voice then that says to Jesus, from Jesus, this is in chapter 14, verse 28. He tells Peter they're all going to desert him, they're going to deny them. But after I have been raised up, I shall go before you to Galilee. That's the lover. Even facing their kind of complete failure as disciples, he still holds on to them. And that certainly has all been carefully worked out by the writer of this gospel, that he juxtaposes that failure, betrayal, well, with a number of things. The meal itself, which is supposed to be a meal of intimacy and sharing and fellowship, with the betrayal, and then Jesus is kind of staying the course, if you will, but when I am raised up, I will go before you into Galilee. And then that's repeated, if you remember, at the end in the story of the empty tomb, in verse 7, where he says to the women, but go tell Peter, you know, he could have said, who denied me, by the way. I mean, that's the connection, isn't it? Tell Peter and the disciples that I go before them into Galilee. There they will see me. There they will see me. That certainly is the lover's voice. I know for myself that if I like someone, I just tolerate their mistakes left and right. I mean, I'm just almost blind to their deficiencies. And if I don't like anyone, I can hardly see any good in them. You know, it's like there's a sense in which love does give us sight. You know, we see better, if you will. Yes.
Would the story of the rich young man be, you know, a good instance and mark of the impotent lover?
The impotent lover, that's very interesting, yes, yes. I think that could be used really well. Because a young man is drawn, he's attractive, but doesn't have the strength to let go. The discipline, if you will. That's very good. It's a wonderful, yes. Some other
or
examples.
Or the weakling king in that story.
Yeah.
The weakling king, yeah. Any other ideas? Or I don't even know what time it is. Any other ideas? Yes,
I have a question going back to Moore's theory that He talks about the king, well, and especially the warrior. He said that the warrior is serving the king.
Mm-hmm.
Does Moore make a distinction between the warrior serving the king outside of oneself versus the king within? Is he distinguishing the one over the other, or that it's both a part of us?
I think he would say it's both. What, of course, he's really trying to do, and what most psychologists are trying to do, is to work at your inner stuff here. And of course, that then empowers you to see those things and work with them more effectively outside of you, so that you would recognize the role that you're playing in the institution. I think we've all had the experience of say, someone who's really in service to someone else, and continuing upstages that person. Say in a parish where you have the pastor is really in that role of the king. The pastor is really there. I think that's the primary role and energy, you know, that's being used. And then you can have someone who comes in and instead of serving that, ends up trying to upstage it. So it's someone who's taking over that role instead of being effective. I think you just see those energies are misused. Now, what I think you could say is that they haven't come to terms with that within themselves. So if you haven't come to terms with that within yourself, then you don't do well when you're in a situation that demands that you are clear about the roles and the good that you can do.
The concept of the warrior having to serve the king ourself, though somehow then makes us a hierarchy within ourselves again, which is somewhat muted when you say that the lover is the integrating factor. That somehow to me implies non-hierarchy.
Yeah, I don't get any sense of hierarchy out here. It's more like, see, the king is not independent. I think you get a hierarchy when the king is on top and doesn't need anyone else, which is not the true king. I think, again, within 20th century, we have tended to look at leadership as being either autonomous, they can do what they damn please, or the king is kind of the father who's kind of paternalistic and takes care of everyone. And both of those are really dangerous images of leadership. But I think what you have here is a balancing of those. So the king has a certain function to play, but is in need of others, so that the king is not independent and autonomous. So it is working out, I think, balancing those off. For myself, looking at it, I think I have a really weak king. And part of that, I think, is because, now probably other people I work with wouldn't say that. But for myself, I've often been in the role of supporting other people and working with other people. And I know I would rather be, say, the vice president of a school than be or vice principal than be the principal of a school. That I play that role better. Mm-hmm. And one reason is that it leaves me more time to be creative. It's a real responsibility, say, to direct the parish. I mean, there's just a lot of responsibility that comes out of that, and some things get lost. You don't have enough time or whatever. And so I've always been more, I think when I say I have a weak king, then I have to work at being centered. I have to work at really being focused. But I think that's one of the things you can do with this, is to really kind of reflect on which of these energies are strongest within you, which need support, if you will, which need nurturing. And again, I think the biblical text can help us to come to that in instance, and naming our experiences, I think. Yeah, any other comment? Well, I wanted to end with a couple quotations here, which I thought were apropos to the kind of work we're doing here on the text. This is actually taken from a book called Gender and Religion. It says, the verification of the truth of this story ultimately remains dependent not on the marshaling of empirical data, or on logical incontrovertibility, but on the act of mutual recognition, whereby one person discovers an adequate symbolization of his or her life story in the story of another. And it seems to me that's what happens with the Gospels when we read the Gospels. What makes the Gospels true is that our own story can be found within those Gospel stories. And I also think that that's what it means to be Christian. It would mean that you would let those stories really shape your decisions of your life. Those stories would somehow be formative for you. That you would, now when I say formative, I don't mean in the sense that you just kind of passively fall in line, but that you wrestle with those stories. That those stories become a way of having an effect upon you. Another one I like is this one. It says, to read is to play the role of the reader, and to interpret is to posit an experience of reading. So we're, again, a real part of that whole process. And I think the challenge is to get people to do that, to really play the role of the reader, to become actively involved in the story. And however we can help them to do that, I think is useful to them. Even doing that, say, from the pulpit, to help them to, say, play a role or identify with someone in the story. And sometimes, you know, my own sense is, again, we tend to identify with Jesus. I don't know why we do that. But, you know, that's probably the person that we're least like. you know, so part of the empowering, I think, is empowering people to look at the shadow side of their person, you know, to come to terms with that, to see themselves as a King Herod in a situation, not that they're King Herod all the time, but in any given situation. You can think of cases where that would be very useful to come to terms with that kind of negative energy. And then this one I like very much. This is from a book by Amos Wilder, who got into a lot of the literary material of the scriptures way ahead of everyone else, even years ago. But he said this quote, I love it. It says, just because we lack imagination is no reason to think that the ancients did. And in fact, that these stories are very imaginative. And probably what we need more than anything else for reading the scriptures well is playfulness, to be really playful in reading those texts. And I was sharing, I think, with you the other day, John Shea, I don't know if you're acquainted with his work. He's a Catholic priest of the Archdiocese. His last name is S-H-E-A, John Shea. And he does a marvelous thing where he has a gospel story, and then he has a story from life today that touches that story. Maybe it's just one part of that story. I wish I had an example of that. One of my students used that in a paper he did last year, and it was just very effective to show you just one little part, it just illuminates maybe one line of that story. But it's a very effective way of seeing how our lives intersect with these stories. As I remember it, it was the story of, in Matthew, it's peculiar to Matthew's gospel, when they come and ask Jesus whether he's paid his tax. And so he says, well, sons don't have to pay the king tax, which is a wonderful answer. I mean, it's just a playful answer, you know. But then he tells Peter, if you remember, to go down and to catch a fish and open the mouth, and there will be the tax money. Well, you know that has to be a story. You know. That did not happen. That I can be pretty sure. But it's a wonderful, playful story. And what John Shea does is tell the story about this woman who is working, you know, and she gets into the elevator, and she meets this man, and she brushes up against him, and he asks her to go to dinner that night, and they go to dinner that night, and something happens, you know. And what it is, of course, is that those things happen without really our planning them. But we have those serendipitous moments in our life. That it's not unlike opening a fish and finding your tax payment in it. I mean, isn't that wonderful? And so that's what I'm talking about. He's able to kind of put those, and it makes a really fine story sometimes just to read the text and then to read a story that just touches that text. And then, you know, letting people think about that, I think it's really useful. He has a new book that's out that's very nice, but I think any of his readings are very good. So. Okay. Yes?
I was just going to say, Walter Burkhardt in his book, Preaching, I think it's got The Art and the Craft, he talks a lot about imagination and playing with it. And
what's it again? Text. Walter?
It's Walter Burkhardt. He's
Burkhardt.
Got, I think, yeah. I think that's his last name, but anyway, it's close to that. And he's got like 5 books of sermons, which are fabulous, but he also has a book on preaching, which...
That same
yeah,
idea
yeah.
kind of touches
a lot of playfulness in his sermons.
Yes, good. So, okay, well, very good. I'll see you this afternoon. We'll heal you. Okay, thanks.